Joe Stafford recording of a Gershwin song. As I said, throughout the course of the show tonight, we'll be paying attention to the music of George Gershwin as he is celebrated this weekend and all fall here in New York, but specifically this weekend because yesterday was the 100th anniversary of his birth in Brooklyn, across the river. That's where George Gershwin was born. Didn't die here, though. Died in, I believe he died in California. I'm not 100% sure on that, but he died in 37, which made him just under 40 years old when he died. He died in 1937. George and Ira Gershwin, Embraceable You, as performed by Joe Stafford a long time ago. Elvis Costello performed relatively recently. There he is. Well, look at that. I just said his name, and there he was. But for some reason, David, I don't think I hear him. Is the microphone up? And is it coming on Dave Mix? Oh, Dave.
Here comes the engineer.
No, there's something missing there. All right, but he'll fix that for me, I'm sure. We heard all this useless beauty from Elvis Costello. And don't speak yet, because your microphone evidently isn't plugged in. Jeff Buckley with The Sky is a Landfill from the posthumous album. And finally, Sheryl Crow from her new album, The Globe Sessions. She didn't record this album at the Globe Theater over in England, the old Shakespeare Theater, or there is a Globe Theater in Canada as well. No, she recorded it at a studio here in New York called Globe, hence the name The Globe Sessions. Riverwide is the title of that song from Sheryl Crow here on WNEW-FM. I think if I said hello to Elvis Costello now, maybe we could hear him. But if he's going to fool around and not actually speak. Ah, there he is.
There I am.
There he is.
Well, I'm used to this ventriloquism on the radio, actually.
Yeah, that's a...
I was once asked a mime on the... I was once asked a mime on the radio. I know it sounds an extraordinary thing, but I'm sure you're aware of the famous French rock and roll star Johnny Hallyday.
Yes.
And he had a radio show which I appeared on, and I think for reasons of atmosphere, they had a live audience of Johnny fanatics in the audience, and you would go on and, to all intents and purposes, perform for the live audience, but you're in fact lip-syncing to your latest single release. Yeah, it's a Parisian compromise, I can tell you.
So they were actually playing the record.
They're playing the record, but you have to go out there and go through the motions of pretending to sing as Johnny did.
Because it was a live audience.
Because it was a live audience, and they wanted to see some real, you know, flexing of sinew.
There is a recording that exists somewhere. I have a copy of it at home buried away somewhere that's actually called The Best of Marcel Marceau. And it's a vinyl recording on which, you know, nothing exists. I mean, it's two sides of just blank vinyl. But it was actually sold that way in stores, The Best of Marceau. Can you tap dance on the radio?
I've tap danced on television.
Only on
Italian television.
Elvis Costello is my guest tonight. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you. There was a bizarre entrance there, but there you go.
Welcome to Idiot's Delight. This is something that I've wanted to do for a long, long time. Spend some time with you on the radio, so I'm glad we can do it tonight and do it in observance of this extraordinary new project of yours, this new project being the collaboration between Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach. 12 songs and an absolutely fabulous album, which has just been released, actually, I guess Tuesday. It hits the stores.
This album
called Painted from Memory. And we'll talk about that. Elvis does have his guitar with him as well.
You never know what might happen.
So who knows? Stick around. We got to pause here for some commercial messages on WNEW-FM. And here we are on WNEW-FM in New York. Idiot's Delight is the name of the show. And I'm Vince Gelsa. I'm real pleased to have Elvis Costello with me tonight. Elvis, way back in 1978, I guess, or thereabouts, a year or so after you debuted as a recording artist, you and a number of your bandmates at the time, the Stiff Records mates, went on the road together.
That was actually the back end of 77.
77, yeah. Okay, Stiff Tour. And there was actually an album called Stiff Live that came out of that particular experience. And one finds, when one goes all the way back to the Stiff Live album, which came out in 78, that Elvis Costello, at the height of what we could call the punk era, I guess, late 70s, you know?
Yeah, that's what people have called it, yeah.
Was performing with those Stiff Records guys a Burt Bacharach, Hal David song.
Yeah, we did. I just don't know what to do with myself.
Yeah. I thought
we did it. You know, we did it. We didn't just do it for that record. That was part of our show at the time.
It was.
I don't know. I just had a feeling for the song, as I still do, and I still like to sing it. And it was kind of good to work against the grain a little bit. You know, we only had one slow song, the song Allison. So it wasn't bad to maybe put the brake on the. You know, we only had about 35 minutes worth of material in those days.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could often knock that off in 20 minutes at the speed we used to play them. We played the songs much faster than we did on a record. And I wasn't saying that we did a cover bit just to make up the time, but it was good maybe just to, you know, get in a thicker feeling on one song and then get back to the more furious rhythm of everything else that we were playing. And that was the song I chose. And it's funny how it's turned out to be a prediction, really.
All these years later, people look at this collaboration between Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach and go, oh, that's, on the surface, it seems like an odd coupling.
Well, it depends on what you know of him and what you know of me and how deep you know Burt's music and whether you know what I've been up to in recent times or whether maybe the... you know, the lingering impression is that from those early years, which of course has much more to do with I guess some kind of rock and roll records, you know, or whatever you call that music we were making then. It was certainly a lot of it was fast and had a lot of edges to it, you know, had a lot of it was quite abrasive sounding.
But when you did this song back then, it was without tongue-in-cheek or anything
absolutely,
like that.
Yeah. It was absolutely it, right? Unironic. I think that's one of the things that I've to this day, I find a bit bewildering about some tastemakers in modern music sort of bestow their, you know, their goodwill upon Burt Bacharach music in a kind of slightly ironic way. And I find it kind of bewildering because I think it's such deeply felt music in many of his ballads. I do genuinely think he's the equal of Richard Rodgers, or you mentioned Gershwin. I think he's, you know, and this obviously... sounds immodest because I'm working with the man, but and he might think this was overpraise, but I genuinely think you could put Alfie alongside My Funny Valentine.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's of the same order of composition, of excellence, and people miss that has to come from something deeply felt. It's not just down to clever use of instrumentation or ingenious time signature. It's about something being deeply felt. And sure, he's written a lot of light, brighter tunes, which perhaps people are familiar with numerous renditions, including ones which maybe reduce them a little bit, you know? But I certainly have never had an ironic view of his music right from the start. It's always been... I learned most of his songs through listening to English artists, you know, who had the jump on those tunes that we first heard in the early 60s. Dionne Warwick's hits came thick and fast, but we also heard a lot of local artists like Cilla Black and particularly Dusty Springfield.
Dusty was
still... You know, to me, the pantheon of female singers is, you know, Aretha, you know, and Dusty and Joni Mitchell sort of fighting it out for second place. And I mean, it's important to compare those kind of stylists because they're so different. But, you know, Aretha is way out in front of everybody, I think. And then Dusty, I can't think of anybody I like to hear more than her. And you know, even Dionne, and even sometimes in the same songs, because I grew up with a familiarity being, brought up in England. Some of these fabulous records by Dionne Warwick, I didn't get to hear her versions until much later.
Yeah, but
we just got to hear the Dusty or the Sandy Shore or the Zoop Money and the Big Roll Band. You know?
Oh, really?
you know, which is another song of Burt's that I covered only a few years ago, only 9 years ago. Please Stay.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was just a tip of the hat to Zoop Money as much as to Burt.
Yeah.
You know, that was a record I heard in 1964, and it was a cover of a Drifters record. And in those days, you know, the English artists had a little bit of, they had a few weeks to get their local fame to work in their favor before we heard the authentic American version. There was about a 6-week gap, and quite often it was not unusual to see two versions of the same song in the charts.
Isn't that
days.
Interesting? Yeah.
A little sidelight.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to 1977.
Okay.
Late 77, and listen to this early collaboration between Elvis Costello and the Attractions, I guess. Was this the Attractions?
Yeah, it's the Attractions,
And a Burt Bacharach, Hal David song.
Forgive me the wrong chord changes.
Burt Bacharach and Hal David.
there you have Dusty's version of it, which was, now, was that the first version that you heard?
That's
was
the first version I heard, okay. Yeah. And then I heard the Tommy Hunt version until very recently.
Tommy Hunt?
Tommy Hunt on Scepter Records, that's okay. The original version, okay. I think. And then Dionne Warwick recorded it later, I think, maybe she recorded, I'm not even, yeah, I think she did,
yeah,
later on.
I think she did it.
But this was the one I heard, and those sheets of, I don't know what label, Philips Reverb there. Dusty was on Fontana or Philips, and it's like wherever studio they recorded in, they had some serious compressors, didn't they, and some serious spring echo, I think, on that record. It's like sheets of it coming off there. There's more echo than there is playing.
Well, we heard the Elvis. We heard the Elvis version as well from Stiff's Live,
yeah.
An album that came out in 78. That tour that you did with Nick Lowe and Ian Dury and all those folks.
All other guys.
And in between, something from the brand new album, a piece called The Sweetest Punch, which is a lovely play on words in the title, because it refers to a variety of punches. And yet, a sweet punch can also be a drink as well, can't it? So
yeah, you know, I never thought of that.
Yeah, the sweet punch. Right?
Yeah. That would be my Noel Coward phase if I'd written that one. Yeah, no, it's no, I didn't mean it that way, but yeah, I guess it could.
My favorite part of that particular song is when the bells are ringing in the lyrics, and then they do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of like. I think we're allowed one or two musical jokes, you know, I mean, the musical joke's making a bit too much of it, but sometimes it's good when things come in on cue. It happens in another place in the record where...
The violins.
We talk about it, people falling in love, and, you know, in an unlikely place, not across a candlelit table, but in a grimy street, and... You know, in the movies, they always have this music swell up, which always makes me amused. I remember there were, you know, the few times people have made jokes about that in films, about the idea of music always appearing in the romantic moment. But in my imagination, it would be some guy in a doorway playing a fiddle, you know. Uh-huh. But we cue a whole lot of strings at that point, you know.
Well, can we talk about that a little bit, Elvis, about the arrangements on this album and where they come from? I mean...
I think, you know, we wrote these songs over a period of, I guess, 2 years. We began, of course, with the composing of God Give Me Strength for Alison Anders' film Grace in My Heart. And so that was, at the time, it was only, I thought it was a one-off collaboration. And having enjoyed that and having enjoyed recording the version of it, which closes this album now, we went on and, you know, got into the process of taking it on to the next stage, which was writing in the room together. Because previously to that, we communicated over the transatlantic telephone line using fax machines and everything, which is a bizarre way to write a song. But that was due to the movie deadline.
Now, it was Alison who had the idea of getting you together?
It was a combination of Alison Anders and Karen Rackman, who's the music supervisor for that film and a number of other notable films like Pulp Fiction and Boogie Nights and Bulworth. She's done some great work in kind of providing the music or the musical, you know, putting together the musical accompaniments for a number of recent films. And the two of them got together and they had approached a number of songwriters to ghostwrite songs for the main character. The main character of Grace in My Heart was an imaginary songwriter in a Brill Building period. And they approached myself and Bert, and Joni Mitchell wrote Man from Mars, which is on her great new album. Her version of it is, at least, but the original version was on Grace in My Heart soundtrack.
Oh.
And Jerry Goffin wrote with his daughter Louise. So there was a feeling of the songs that the imaginary songwriter was seen to write during the movie were actually ghostwritten by a number of appropriate people, you know.
Well, that songwriter was sort of a loosely based Carol King kind of character.
Yeah,
very loosely based.
Yeah, I'd say more than a little bit loosely based. And then it went kind of like sort of sideways halfway through. You could follow a kind of a parallel for a while, and then the story took it on a more fantastic line. But, you know, we had a deadline to write to, so hence this bizarre way of writing together over the telephone. So getting together in the room meant that we could spend a lot more time discussing, you know, real precise details of the composition, and we were able to make a musical dialogue in some of the songs. A song like I Still Have That Other Girl would be section by section originated with one or the other person. Other songs would be more completely written by one writer, musically speaking, and the other might make a very small contribution, either like a form of editing or, you know, sort of a change to a melodic line, or, you know, Bert would get inside some lines of music of mine and shift the meter around or shift the harmonies around a little bit and create some sort of tension that was desirable, and then I'd work on the words. So by the time we finished them, we had been knocking these songs around quite a bit at the piano, and the ideas about how they should sound were pretty clear to us. You know, they were sort of written with the sounds of the record in mind. Bert had, on the very last writing session that we did, which was, I think it was after the TNT special that we were talking about before we went on the air, which was a television show of Bert's music, which I took part in. We got together in Los Angeles, so I guess that might have been in April this year, and Bert had already sketched out some of the orchestration, and we went through it at the piano, and there were some surprises, but the orchestration mainly came out of the composition.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't like a superstructure, wasn't like something I had to accept that was separate to the music that we'd written together. It was very integrated.
And is the fact that this...
discreet as well, I should say.
Yeah, the orchestrations so very much fit into the Burt Bacharach sound of the 60s, that classic, you know, late 60s, early 70s sound, that it's almost like a seamless jump back in time, and yet it's extremely modern. It's not...
Yeah, I don't see it as sounding that. I think if you listen, say, to a record, particularly a record like Dusty's, where they're really trying to imitate what they heard from America, and they're trying to listen to records, probably no access to charts, certainly not to orchestration, and just reading it off, you know, probably having somebody in an office transcribing it off a 45, and how wrong it is. You know, there are voicings that are different in the harmony. If you listen to Tommy Hunt's, like the figure that's on the record, the main figure, that's all voiced differently on the Dusty version. And they're subtle things, but these are very important distinctions to Bert. And these are the things that I really learned from the process, that the real substance of his music lies in these tiny details, the stitches of the music, if you like, in the little kind of nuances and sort of punctuations, exactly where a line finishes and the space between that and the next line, and the exact voicing of a chord. It's not vague, you know, mm-hmm. and guessed at the way it is on both the versions of I Just Wanted to Do It Myself that we've heard tonight.
Right.
But it's something a little bit more precise, and it sounds, when I talk about it, like it's a very pedantic thing, but all it means is that when you come to the moment of playing it, you have the certainty that you've got something really strong that you're really sure about, and the sounds that you're hearing, I don't hear them as a retrospective or a retrogressive step musically. I hear it very much in the moment. They're just sounds that'll never get old, because they're the sounds of natural instruments.
Uh-huh.
I think Bert would really take issue with I think I've played him a few slightly more obscure songs of it from his catalog, and asked him about them, and songs that have fascinated me for a long while, and he says it's like listening to another person.
Mm.
He couldn't begin to compose like that now, and I think that I don't think that's what we were being asked to do even from the off when we had a license to write in a 60s style. I think we both thought it was too good an opportunity not to write a song of the moment, you know?
I guess what I mean is that there are certain signature sounds.
There are signatures, no doubt, yeah.
The horns, the backup vocalists, you know, that...
I think they're used in a dramatic sense to carry on the story. In a couple of songs, they actually take the lead line, as it were. I stop singing and they say what the next line in the mm-hmm. song is, so mm-hmm. they have a dramatic role, you know, like a little Greek chorus in there, and sometimes even instruments do that, even though they don't have any words attached to them. The music actually has a, you know, because it's got feeling to it, it carries on the thought in music that may have ended in words, and that was, you know, trusting to that, you know. But you would be quite surprised, I think, if you pointed at certain things that are in these compositions, because I didn't come to it feeling that I don't have anything to prove anymore in terms of, like, whether I'm rough and tough and, you know, whether my records have more edge than Marilyn Manson or something. You know, I have nothing to prove.
Mm-hmm.
His music is fine for people that want to listen to it, and mine is for the people that want to listen to what I do. I don't have anything to prove, so I felt that I could kind of leave my guns at the door, if you know what I mean, to some
mm-hmm.
extent.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to sort of force Bert to write a Pump It Up or something with me, you know, just to see whether it would work as a horrible kind of experiment. I felt that if I brought my view of what I thought his style was, as the ballad style that I've always loved, that we would write more compatibly and create something stronger and more real and more of the moment, because I've always loved these elements of his writing. So you might point to some things in the songs that say they're typically Bacharach, and you'd actually find I'd written that, you know, because they might be, you know, written in sort of, not an imitation, but in an attempt to find that place where we can be together, you know?
Well, so many of your songs over the years fit very logically into the whole lyrical and musical context of this collaboration as well. So that's really what you're saying, you know?
As I said to you before, when people express a little bit of surprise, it's only maybe because they haven't, for maybe no fault of their own, heard some of the things I've done in recent times, which maybe give more clue to why we would be able to work together. Mm-hmm. But today, with an open-minded view, so, you know, it's a, you know, with all the great songs he's written, why in the world would he want to get into a situation where he's not even total control of the music? I think that's a very brave move. Bear in mind, this is something he's never done before. All his collaborations have been, well, his most famous collaborative partner was purely a lyricist, and in his later collaborations, the musical input was comparatively small with Carol Bayer-Sager and even Neil Diamond, I think, mm-hmm. Yeah. He would still be very much the dominant partner musically, I think, in most of the compositions.
So
to give up that, I think, was really brave, much more of a leap than for somebody like me. It just gave me a lot of discipline for the lyric writing, really.
Mm-hmm.
The big jump for me. You know?
But you are able to work on the music as well with him.
That was the pleasure of it, to have a conversation in music, and sometimes we would have a difference about the way something should go, and the strength of writing together is not sort of giving in from one to the other so much as finding a third way that's a better third way out of the best bits of your two opposing views of one section of music, and that third view would actually be even stronger. Might take you a couple of days to get to it, and we might sort of look bewildered at each other on a few occasions. I say, this is absolutely how it goes, and he'd go, I just can't hear it, I can't feel it, you know.
Now, this is a relatively new and different situation for you as well. You don't generally co-write songs with people.
Well, I've written a number of songs over the years, but each collaboration has been different in nature. You know, I've either put words directly to a composition, as I did with Shipbuilding for Clive Lang. I wrote that music for Robert Wyatt, and then I recorded it. I've written a number of songs with my wife, you know, but that's obviously something you kind of almost fall into. You live together, so you're writing the song, and, you know, we're doing, you know, the washing up, and I say something, and she says something, and oh, that's the line. You know, it's not a thought about arranged process. I wrote 12 songs with Paul McCartney, which was a more intense kind of face-to-face writing situation. Yeah. But it's one that didn't involve writing down any music, so there was a distinct difference. It was music conceived and then caught spontaneously, and then had to be reanimated in performance later. With Bert, there's the catching of the idea, sometimes done independently, bringing it together, really examining it in a lot of detail, and putting it under the microscope and really pushing it until the best version of it emerges. And then, when you've got that best version, then you have the spontaneous moment in the performance. But with the security of the written music gives you the plan. It's the blueprint, you know, it's only the blueprint.
And how does that differ from the collaboration with McCartney?
Well, nothing was written down.
You don't write anything down.
He doesn't write music down, and I didn't at the time.
Yeah.
When we started, I didn't begin to write music down until I started to work with the Brodsky Quartet. And then it just became an inhibition to the progress of working with them, because being classical musicians, they understood music as I played it to them on the piano, but my piano playing is very erratic, and they would think they had grasped the passage I'd played, and then I played another time, I'd play slightly differently, just because of stray fingers. And it was just quicker to write it down, you know, then we could say, that's what I really mean, and let's work on that together,
you know?
So once I got to grips with that, it made communicating with musicians that were used to that notation a lot easier and clearer. Yeah.
I read somewhere that one of the things that that influenced Bacharach in getting involved in the collaboration with you was his knowledge of the work with the Brodsky Quartet.
He was very complimentary about the fact that I'd gone, you know, I suppose away a little bit from what people expected, and you know, I think that his music has a great sense of adventure to it. Although he has a very distinct and recognizable style, there's tremendous ambition in terms of musical ambition, not in terms of like, oh, this is commercial. He's been blessed with a lot of commercial success, but I think that's because the tunes are very memorable and very deeply felt. But there has, you know, he obviously recognizes attempts to just try something different, and heaven knows this is something different for both of us, you know, writing together and writing with these sounds in mind, you know, for him maybe as well, because, you know, for a period of time he admits that, you know, we said this record has moved him back towards the natural instruments and the orchestra, away from maybe more machines and playing piano. You're saying that, yeah, I wasn't playing so much piano on my own records, maybe standing back and maybe shaping the sound from the outside, whereas on this record, he's the pianist on all but one of the songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One more question about the origins of the collaboration. When you got a phone call from someone saying, hey, would you like to write a song with Burt Bacharach for this movie, was there a moment of hesitation?
None whatsoever. I mean, I had met Burt briefly before in a studio by sheer chance, and I knew him to be a very, very fine gentleman, and I knew that we could get along from that meeting, but I thought it would be just that crazy to turn up the opportunity to see where it went, you know? Yeah. I didn't know we were going to have to write it in maybe 5 days and over the phone because I'm in Dublin and he's in LA when I agreed to do it. Otherwise, I might have been a bit more apprehensive, and the most nerve-wracking aspect was sort of sending him that first sheet of music and not being able to look him in the eye when he looked over the ideas. And, you know, that turned out to be the opening of God Give Me Strength. So that's not, you know, the opening of the verse of God Give Me Strength. He made a couple of subtle changes, but, you know, it must have been a fairly strong opening idea because a good song developed from it. So it was worth that chance. And I didn't really have any second thoughts, I wouldn't say, you know. That sounded like we scripted that one. How we doing? We doing all right for time? Yeah. When do you want to?
Oh,
are you? I'm going to do the next one. No, I'm fine for a while. If you are.
Mm-hmm. Now I have nothing, so God.
We're doing I Still Have That Other Girl.
Oh, really?
Because I'm weak.
Well, it's... Yeah, I don't know whether it's really... What does that mean?
Strong, yeah, exactly. Emphasis.
Yeah. Could they make it sound any less exciting? Emphasis cut. You know what? I think that might be better just a little bit further away. Just a little bit. Just because I... This, the singing one, because I think... I don't know how...
That song appeared on the soundtrack to the film Grace of My Heart, and
right.
It is now part of the new Elvis Costello with Burt Bacharach album, the album called Painted from Memory. I have to tell you that just this afternoon, Elvis, I was speaking with Joey Ramone and told him...
As you do.
As I do.
How's he doing?
He's my only friend in like, you know, the rock and roll world, like where we actually do speak as friends, not as as business associates. Mm-hmm. He's doing okay. He's been under the weather, but he's doing okay at the moment. And I told him you were going to be on tonight, and he said that when he saw that being performed on the Bacharach, the special, that it made him cry.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. So
it's a couple of people told me that, and it was a special moment for me. You could get all soppy show business about it, but because we'd worked on the songs a while, and it was the only brand new song in the show that this house is empty now, and God Give Me Strength was, you know, fairly unknown to people as well. So we were basically doing two unknown songs to the general public, I would say, in amongst a whole program of Bacharach. Million sellers, many of them, and although they were not only a couple of them were sung by the original artists, that was a daunting thing, and I was, you know, I was very touched by the way people reacted to the songs, hearing them, it seemed like for the first time, you know. Some people knew God Give Me Strength from the original recording, the soundtrack recording, but This House Is Empty Now, the other song we performed that night, was a
very totally new
world premiere, as they say at the Metropolitan Opera. Yeah. You know, it was a scary tightrope walking moment.
And he said the point at which that chill went through him was when you reach for that note, that high note, when you go up for it, you know. And you were speaking off the air about the challenge of singing Burt Bacharach, you know, the challenge of singing these melodies.
Yeah, whoever's ended up writing the, you know, and obviously after a while, when you enter in a collaboration, you have to forget whether you came up with that portion of melody or section of music, because the process of working together makes it both your property, you know. But so we've constructed these melodies, some of which are quite challenging, and I would certainly not. I have no choice about the fact, I just have the voice I have, and it's never been an easy voice. I'm a fallible vocalist, but I enjoy the challenge of reaching for certain things that I feel there's an excitement in reaching for these things which are on the edge of my range, on the edge of my ability. If I sang blandly within my voice all the time, I mean, it can be an attractive sound to sing gently, and there are a number of songs where I sing very gently, and Burt encouraged me to widen my dynamic range so that the openings of certain songs are very gentle and they build with the drama of the song, and you're reaching for those moments, and some of them are pretty, you know, they're pretty high. They would frankly be beyond many singers who are technically better than me, but they perhaps wouldn't take the risks that I take, you know. And maybe when I'm an old man I'll regret going up there quite so often, but you're reaching for something, and it's reaching for a feeling. It's not just whether that's A or you know, G sharp or whatever it is, it's reaching for the feeling that you've written into the song, and you're trying to tell a story, and it's got to be represented truly in music. And that's what we've written, and that's what we've agreed on after all this process of writing together, words and music. Whoever wrote the original theme, whoever suggested the twist and turn that delayed the payoff of the harmony, and, you know, whether or not I feel I got exactly the right words to express what the story of the song was meant to represent. There's a moment when it's just happening, and you've got these sounds around you, and you really have no choice but just to reach for the feeling. Or the same way, to hold back and get into the moment of it, some more delicate thing which requires a different kind of control, you know?
Elvis Costello is my guest tonight here on WNEW-FM in New York. We'll take a commercial break, and then will you play a song for us?
I'll play a song, by all means.
Maybe one of these new songs?
Yeah, maybe, even right. That.
Okay. This is WNEW-FM in New York. I'm Vin Scalza. Elvis Costello is my guest tonight. Here on Idiot's Delight. These songs were written on piano for the most part, right?
That's right.
You and Burt at two different pianos in a room?
Sometimes,
together?
Yeah. Well, obviously we prepared compositions and then we'd bring them to the writing sessions, and then they'd get put through the process of looking at every little, you know, every little crotchet and quaver. Mm-hmm. And you know, then I'd take them away. Whatever we ended up with at the end of a 5-day period, there would be a couple of recognizable shapes, and some of them would have a title or maybe a couple of sketchy lines, and I'd develop the story a bit more in response to what we'd written. As the songs took more shape musically, it was easier to see where the emphasis lay lyrically, you know.
How active was he in the writing of the lyrics as well?
Well, he doesn't contribute anything per se to the lyrics in terms of the invention, but the shape of the melodies, beyond a certain point of development, is not really negotiable. So a lyrical-driven songwriter, as I have been maybe up until the last 5 years, where I feel as if in my own work the emphasis has gone very much towards the music, perhaps in the last 10 years, but especially in the last 5 years, where the lyrics are almost secondary in importance to the music, which I never would have said early on. I mean, I read occasionally references to my work where I feel as if they're talking about a different person. Somebody that could talk about wordplay and stuff, which I think was apparent, or puns and stuff that I still get referred to in those terms. I mean, it's like there's a sort of file review somewhere that says these things, and it really bewilders me because I can't hear it in. And maybe I try not to make a meal of the turns of phrase that just simply say something, you know. And if they catch the ear, then that's good, but that doesn't necessarily make them clever per se, you know. They're just there to kind of stick in the brain and say something that means something and carries some emotional weight. So in recent times the music's led the way, so it was a natural thing for me to obey the shape of the music. It was hard sometimes to actually fit you know, with a song I'm going to sing for you in a minute, there's a section in the middle where there's only a few notes in each part of the phrase in which to say anything. And it's daunting to find just something that has meaning when you've been used to just bending the rules. I mean, some of my songs from early on, every verse is a different shape. Mm. You know, it's a really difficult thing for bands to remember the shape of songs, particularly when you're full of vodka or something in the early days, you know. And every verse in the song is a different length. Or, you know, the line that's identical in verse 2, except for those two extra beats on the end of the line, you know. It's like really... really demanding in a different way, even though superficially it's very simple looking. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And the challenge, of course, is to make it appear at the end very simple.
Yeah, well, in my earlier songs, which did have that kind of colloquial way of using a lot of words and flying through, and the music was made to bend to the lyric, I never really felt that it was ever clever to do that. It was just necessary for me to get that meaning over, so I would use those extra couple of notes in a line, jam words in right to the end of the bar. And with Bert, he's got a much more, you know, a much more sense of what you'd be losing by doing something like that, because a couple of lines later, you really want that space to have been created leading up to a key moment in the song. So it was, you know, it was exacting but good discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, occasionally he would mumble a word under his breath while he was playing something like In This House Is Empty Now. He mumbled the word, remember. And the word remember became kind of a pivotal word in each verse, or a reference to reminiscence, mm-hmm. at least. And I wrote the song outwards from one word.
From that
so,
word.
You know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
He did. He's too modest, you know, then he says, and the sounds of certain lines of melody seem to have words kind of attached to them, or the feeling of a song like Such Unlikely Lovers was, I definitely knew it was about somebody walking down the street, and then the romantic element of the tune suggested that it was a chance encounter that led to a romantic entanglement, but not one in a predictable, certain, not a cliched one, because the tune was surrealistically romantic, I felt, as it didn't need to have, you know, a brutal storyline. Mm. Some of the other songs are quite have a darker tone, like obviously In the Darkest Place does, and My Thief, somebody having a dream about the same dream about their lover every night, but they rather have that dream than no dream, because the person's actually gone, and they would rather have them in a kind of fantastic version, in a haunted version, than nothing at all. Mm. So, you know, the songs are not necessarily all sunny in outlook, you know. Yeah. I don't think they're depressing, but they're on the more melancholic side of
it. Yeah, they're definitely melancholy.
Yeah. They're very, well, we set out to do that. Yeah. We said that's a strength I felt in his writing that I've always appreciated, and it's one that I go towards. And it's something that if you have a lot of feeling and experience for that area, both in yourself, in life, and in music, then you should go to that area and try and use the strongest thing possible to make the join between us. And it's an endless subject for people. You can't run out of, you know, because it's why we're all here. Mm-hmm. It's love and mm-hmm. desire mm-hmm. and all the other things that come along with it, trust and fidelity and the breaking of trust and the loss of love. It's a heart, you know, it's about different forms of heartbreak. And it's not like over a whole record you wouldn't run out of things to say or things to sing about or things to be inspired about. If we'd set out to sort of write this one's going to be about wheat fields, that might have been more difficult, you know. It's tough, you know. Having said that, now the song I'm going to sing might seem to contradict that, because
the song called
this song is called Toledo.
Toledo, yeah. So tell about it. This is the Toledo, Ohio.
This song is about a man comes home very early in the morning one morning, and he sees the light on his phone machine, you know, one of those phones with a answering machine in it, and sees a light blinking, and he knows that that light means that he's been discovered in an infidelity, because he wasn't there to answer the phone. That's said, that's unspoken before the song ever begins.
Mm.
And it's really just about how he delays the confession. And you know, I said to somebody the other day that I never believed that when we wrote this song that we might be writing topical songs. Nevertheless, somebody like delaying the confession of an infidelity. But there you go. That's mm-hmm. that's just an accident of history, you know. But and he makes this little rhyme up in his head about the contrast between Toledo, Ohio, and Toledo in Spain. But it's just another way of saying the grass is always greener, you know. So which is what tempts people into this sort of thing in the first place. Mm. And unfortunately, it's the one song on the record that I seem to have managed some kind of accompaniment on the guitar. You'll forgive me, or somebody will have to forgive me, maybe my co-writer will have to forgive me if I modify a few of the changes here to play it on the guitar for you. Okay. It happens to be that, fortunately, this guitar used to belong to Joni Mitchell. Do you hear that? It really did. I think it's still got some of her chords in it.
All through the night I telephoned. I saw the light blinking red beside the cradle. But you don't know how far I've gone. Now I must live with the lie that I made. But if I call, I know I won't have to say it. You'll hear my voice. Something is bound to betray it. But do people living in Toledo know that the name hasn't traveled very well? And does anybody in Ohio dream of that Spanish citadel? But it's no use saying that I love you, and now that girl really didn't mean a thing to me. For if anyone should look into your eyes, it's just forgiveness that they're gonna see. You hear her voice. How could you do that? You hear voice, how could you do that? So I walked outside in the bright sunshine, and lovers passed by, smiling and joking, but they don't know the fool I was. Why should they care what was lost, what was broken? But if I call, I know I won't have to say it. You'll hear living in Toledo know that the name hasn't traveled very well. And does anybody in Ohio dream of that Spanish citadel? But it's no use saying that I love you, and how that girl really didn't mean a thing to me. For if anyone should look into your eyes, it's not forgiveness that they're gonna see. But we still have Florence, Alabama. We don't have Paris, and we don't have Rome or New York or even Amsterdam. None of those lonely towns will be my home.
It's Elvis Costello live on the radio here on WNEW-FM. Toledo is the title of that song.
For everybody. God. That isn't on the record. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. It got very, very quiet. Very, very quiet.
This is the new singing quiet thing. We're listening on the radio. I don't need to shout. We've got a microphone.
Exactly.
A whole radio station.
It's a very intimate medium, radio. Mm. It really is. Very one-on-one.
That's what they... Don't they tell you that? That when you're speaking on, you're supposed to think like you're singing to one person. Or talking to one person. Mm-hmm. It's a very rare sort of feeling, because normally when you make records, you maybe try and think specifically about the people that, you know, that'll be listening to it. But if you thought about a whole crowd, that would be crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe certain kinds of, maybe heavy metal, you have to imagine a big crowd. But I would imagine, you know, if I imagine anything at all other than what's going on in the song, it would have to be one.
I always think of one person as the audience for what I do on the radio, and that one person is very much alone, has like actively decided to be alone, separate him or herself in a room somewhere to listen to the radio. That's how I like to do it.
Well, I hope that, I mean, the record particularly, I mean, obviously this is a very unusual way to debut a song. For a lot of people wouldn't have heard that song in the full arrangement. Obviously there were other things around the voice. I mean, the part of the song I was telling you about, though, where there were just a few notes, was this little bit here. I don't know whether you can still hear me, can you, on the guitar? Mm-hmm. In the bridge here, where after the chorus, after this guy has given this rhyme of, you know, really just like an alibi, this thing about Toledo, it's like an alibi in his mind to delay the moment where he has to say what the unthinkable. And actually on the record, the vocal group come in and sing with me. In fact, I'm always singing to myself very quietly like I did just here in this thing. And Bert gave me these few notes, and I couldn't think what on earth we were going to put on just these few notes, and it ended up being this. You hear her voice, how could you do that? You hear her voice, how could you do that? And that's just, you know, it's quite difficult to think of, but it's one of my favorite bits, and I'm glad we inserted that little thought, because that's when the knife twists on the guy. He deserves it, I guess.
Well, now, the audience listening to us right now is familiar with the recorded version, because we've had a copy of the album for the last month or so.
Oh, have you? Well, there you go. I'm telling them stuff they already know, but at least they know that, you know. But that's like a little bit where I feel like, you know, that's where you can get inside it a little bit for me. And I look for those moments in songs, whether they're new or old. I mean, there's no point in singing unless you can find those moments. And having somebody whispering in your ear in this beautiful sound, the way they sing with me, that really helps.
Let's listen to it.
All through the night you telephoned, I saw the light the cradle.
Toledo, know that their name has been traveled everywhere. And does anybody in Ohio
dream of that Spanish citadel?
Elvis Costello with Burt Bacharach from the new album. I notice now that I finally have a finished copy of the album. This copy that I've been playing for the last month or so was an advance without any of the cover art or anything like that, Elvis. The lyrics are not included in the finished.
No, I didn't think they were. They're pretty clear to understand, I think. And I didn't really want. There are no hidden meanings. There are no hidden messages in my songs, you know, contrary to what some people seem to think. I'm not sending secret messages out to people, you know. I mean, you might be speaking to one person, but it's very specifically like anybody that can imagine themselves in the moment or the feeling of the song, whether it's a far-fetched song. I mean, some of the songs I've written in the last few years have very individual points of view, like a song like Poor Fractured Atlas that you were playing from All This Use Is Beauty. Right, you were playing All This Use Is Beauty. That's another one. It's not a particularly... it's outward looking, but it's not outward in its expression. It's a private thought then shared. These songs, I think, are they're quite private moments, but they're outward looking in the looking to shared experience. I tried to find in the lyrics kind of ways of saying them originally, I hope, but in the simplest language that I think that I've ever used in any lyrics. And because of the space that's created by the actual structure of the music, the architecture of the music, particularly that which Bert composed, there just simply wasn't the tendency in me to want to go off into purple language. You know, I did attempt it a few times in the writing of the songs, and it never worked. Uh-huh. It seemed to compete with the music, and when I kept the word simpler, it seemed to be truer to the feeling. And anybody can understand this. Most of these songs on first hearing, I don't understand. There's no hidden meanings, you know?
My first listen to these songs was 4 or 5 weeks ago, whenever it was. And I had to take the record off. I was in the car, and I was listening to the CD.
That's a good sign.
Listening to the CD in the car, and here's why I had to take it off. I was so emotionally moved by what was going on because I had just brought my daughter, my only child, to college. Right? She's leaving home.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I dropped her off at school, and I'm driving home, and I'm listening to the new Elvis Costello Burt Bacharach album, and the songs are so sad. And I got to, like, what, track 4, This House is Empty Now. I think that's track 4.
Yeah.
And I just said, I'm sorry, I can't listen. So I'm paying you the highest compliment.
Well,
I couldn't listen to you.
No, I don't mind that at all. You know, this is the funny thing. People might think it's flipped to... You know, for me to be laughing and like, we had a problem. See, one of the big problems we had was making cover art for this record because Bert is a natural smiling kind of guy, and I spent 20 years staring down the camera, you know. And when we took our pictures together, like, either I looked like I had some sort of bad smell was being held under my nose in order to make me open my mouth and show what's left of my teeth, or if Bert, you know, didn't smile, he looked like somebody had stolen his puppy or something. It just, like, we were both like had the very bad reaction to being asked to do. And in the end, some of the pictures that you'll see in the papers of us are two guys like having good time because we relaxed a little bit in the photo session. And I was worried that it might seem to like contradict or make people think that we didn't mean the music, but it's simultaneously having really enjoy the process of working together, enjoying each other's company. I don't think there's anything wrong with people knowing that that's the case, you know, that this isn't some sort of mad A&R man scheme, you know, that the people at the record company have been very encouraging about this, but it's not something that's been put together in a scientific laboratory. It's something that came together through a natural process, you know. And Ken's out there smiling, I know, so representative of the record company's out at the point, what? No, we thought it was hard. I want people to know that we enjoyed each other's company. At the same time, trying to strike the note, the tone of the music is quite difficult. And to talk about it not racked with pain all the time, because that's not this. The title of the album is Painted from Memory. That the songs are very real to me in the moment I'm singing them. But I don't want people to think that it's like this is me in the moment. I don't need songs to be my diary. You know, I've never written a diary in my life. I don't write out of direct experience, unedited. I write out of experience, observation, and hopefully some imagination, and look for the inspiration to get it down. And in this case, with an unbelievable musical writing partner, to make it into something that's alive. But I don't feel it's necessarily the place. For me, it isn't the place for, you know, Jerry Springer's place for confession, you know, or the Catholic Church, you know, one of those places. Either will do.
Jerry Springer and or the Catholic Church. That's, yeah, okay.
Choose your poison.
Jimmy Webb, the great songwriter, has just written a very scholarly book about songwriting.
I think I read an excerpt from it.
It's wonderful. Yeah. And Jimmy's been a frequent guest on the show.
Explain how he wrote High Pockets. Do you know that song?
No, I don't think he actually got to that one. But he talks about a dilemma that songwriters face, which is what you're talking about here, and being involved in relationships, whether it's with a wife, a lover, family members. Writing songs that are intensely personal and yet are fiction, and having to frequently explain that to somebody who's looking over your shoulder and saying, "Well, wait a minute, is that me in that song?"
Oh,
is
yeah, no, I think you've got, you know, I mean, if you live with a grown up person, you know, that ain't going to happen.
Mm.
You know, I mean, only wooden headed actors fall in love on the set, you know.
a lot of them do, though.
Well, wooden headed actors, though, you know, the whole class, you know. Yeah. But I mean, it doesn't have to be like that, you know, it's no less real. I mean, actors that are good, you believe in them implicitly. You know, if they're a murderer or a lover or a pirate or a cowboy or an astronaut, you know, and why can't a singer be the same thing, you know? And I mean, I read this really great account Martha Gellhorn wrote about her marriage to, she was questioned about her marriage to Hemingway, am I saying the right name? And she said, her account of this one particular incident, the Spanish Civil War, was, you know, that really as it happened. And Hemingway's account was like they went up this mountain on a lame donkey and they came down in an armored car, you know, being attacked by a machine gun. And nothing like that happened at all. But guess what? You know, she was a sort of witness and he was a writer.
Mm.
So where's the surprise?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was making a fiction out of it, part of an experience. And so, you know, you say, okay, well, he was aggrandizing himself. Well, say maybe he was, but, you know, that's vanity of humans, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And your wife is a songwriter. You've co-written with her as well. So presumably she understands this process.
Well, you know, I don't think we pay... It seems a funny thing to say. The details of music and the details of writing, I mean, I'm aware of the work that goes into it, and sometimes it gets dark, you know, when it won't come right and you can get very down and it's all gone away, you're never going to write another song again, just like everybody has doubts. You wouldn't be human if you didn't. Sometimes songs come very easily to me, or they come quickly. It's not to say that, you know, like the first song of this record, In the Darkest Place, it took from April to April to complete, and mainly lyrically. And most of the music was written in a very brief space of time, but finding exactly how the story kind of concluded or developed and then concluded took about 5 drafts. That's an unusual amount of time, but maybe that's because it's slightly more exacting music, but I don't feel that it has to, that part of it, maybe somebody else would write a song about that, but that doesn't, I'll tell you about it, I have no shame about it. If it's harder for me sometimes than easier for me, that's fine, but I don't really sit around like, agonizing about the process of it that much. If I thought about it that much, only when it's going badly, then I'm agonizing about it. When it's going well, I don't even think about it. And I don't think we sit around the house worrying about where the next song is going to come up. It's usually by chance. Like the last one we wrote together was in a yellow cab on the way to the studio for the Big Lebowski.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We finished it on as we walked in the door. Kate was writing down the words as we walked in the door.
I have to pause here to take care of some commercial business.
Sure.
This is a commercial radio show.
I know.
On a commercial radio station. And then will you sing some more for us?
Yeah, I'll sing something else, yeah.
Good. You know, Elvis Costello, I've wanted to spend time with you on the radio for 20 years now. And we finally are here doing it. And there are a million things that I want to ask you.
I'll have to come back some other time.
Yes, there are, you know, 100 recordings that I want to play. I mean, we've had an incredible output of work over these.
I'll come in sometime and we do the show together.
Would you do that?
Yeah.
You promise?
Yeah,
okay.
You want to.
But I
have a friend in Dublin and I go on, he has a show called that's similar in you know, range to what you've been talking about this evening, and called The Eclectic Ballroom, and I go in from time to time and with a stack of records that have come from the road, and he's good enough to turn the show over to me for an hour or something, and we'll play just a whole lot of things.
An hour wouldn't be enough.
Yeah, you know? Well, you know,
I will hold you to this.
Yeah, no, absolutely, I'm up for it, because it's I mean, you know, we know the history of radio, and it's been an interesting one, to say the least, over the last 20 years, but I caught the tail end of when most radio was as free format as your program is, before everybody got crazy, you know, and... You know, they've got their reasons for going that road, and that's the way it is, so we work with it. But, I mean, I was used to going into stations like K-San in San Francisco on my first visits and going on for 3 hours and playing Lydia the Tattooed Lady and Howling Wolf, you know, and things like that. And it was, you know, and maybe, you know, we didn't always get to play on the air. I didn't carry electric guitar around with me then.
It's different now.
Acoustic
guitar. It really
guitar.
Is. And I think this album is, it's such a bold move in that it goes against the currents of everything that's happening, really, in pop music right now.
Maybe it is. I just sort of felt that there was there's a place for, particularly, maybe, it would be great, you know. I mean, it doesn't have to be a guy, but I happen to be a guy, so, I mean, singing big ballads with this kind of feeling in a world where most of the ballads, whether the country or R&B or the pop, kind of sound all the same to me, the same production values, whoever the singer is. And that kind of means that I felt that there was something original that could be done in that form at this time. And I've always loved Bert's songs, so that it was easy enough to imagine what this record would be like. Now we've got it and we've got there and made it. It's for people to decide whether they find a place for it in the world. I've no idea whether radio in a broader sense will play this record. To my mind, it could get played on almost any radio station, because for the simple reason it doesn't sound like anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have to be brave enough to give it a spin and not worry so much, you know. There's a lot of making decisions by committee in every class of business, and maybe some of that could be just relax for, you know, 3 minutes or something. You know?
It's something that we've been fighting for such a long time. And
who knows,
it's not only committee, it's committee that's so dictated to by demographics studies, by science. They try to make a science out of
but
it.
You can't, though. There's no formula. I mean, people ask me all the time, like, how do you write songs? And, you know, is it, or looking sometimes for advice, sometimes just simply a curiosity, and there isn't any formula. Otherwise, I would be doing it all the time, making these hit songs, and, you know, and I feel as if I sort of know, my worst nightmare is having a hit with a song I hate. You know, it's some idiot song that I write in a weak moment, you know, and then you have to live with that one for the rest of your life. I mean, remember when we first hit the road, you know, we'd see a couple of bands that were on their way down from the early 70s that were doing maybe the nightclub next to the nightclub that we were playing, and they'd still be dressed up in their stage uniforms from that first hit, and they're doing a, I don't know if it's any names because, you know, it's not fair to the bands, but they'd be wearing some gimmick uniform that was once cute, and there they are still trading on that one hit, and it's some terrible song that they can tell they're all mortally embarrassed to play. Unfortunately, I've got a lot of older songs I'm very fond of, and, you know, people are good enough to want to hear. And I just hope these new songs, I mean, we've got them coming out now. There's going to be another record of these songs coming out in the new year on Verve.
What is that?
Well, it's a jazz orchestra led by Bill Frisell. It's going to, he recorded an instrumental interpretation of these songs.
Wow.
And, we're leading an ensemble, you know, guitar, trumpet, trombone, clarinet, saxophone. It has people like Curtis Fuchs, Don Byron, Billy Bruce, Blade, Victor Krauss.
Cool.
Don Byron, now, I think I said.
Are you saying that there are older songs in your catalog that you feel saddled with? I mean, you're saying that you love a lot of your older songs.
Yeah, well, there's some that I don't, you know, that there aren't, like, in the moment that I wrote them, they don't seem like the way I feel today, so it's harder to connect with them, and, you know, some of those might be favorites, or songs that people really, really like, for some reason, maybe they've been successful even, then, and I don't feel like they're by any means my best song, so it's a little harder to, you know, I will play them sometimes if I get the feeling for them, where I can play them and go at them at a new angle or something, try to find some new way of playing them. I mean, in the live show we're going to do a show in Radio City in a couple of weeks on the 13th.
With Bacharach.
Yes. With Bert. And we're doing, you know, we're going to rehearse in about a week. And of course, one of the real conundrums is what do we play? And, you know, we're going to play the songs from this album. And, you know, we're going to try and represent something of our catalogue. And I just want to take
of each of your separate catalogs.
Yeah, separate catalogs. Right. Yeah, and we, you know, we'll leave the stage to each other for a short period of time in the set, so that can be focused on, and then we'll also do some songs together. You know, I've all, you know, like a, I think you can probably guess. There's a song that kind of goes that we might play. You know, I don't know. We're harking back to about 2 hours ago when I first came here, but I just don't have to do myself. It's got that. It's maybe on the list of songs we might try, but, you know, we haven't quite worked out exactly which we're doing. Uh-huh. But it gives me a chance to look at some of my songs, maybe using the orchestra that we've got on stage. We've got a 30-piece orchestra, and it's going to be interesting to see how the show, you know, works out and which songs we choose. I mean, I don't think it would be the right thing to do to try and cram in a whole lot of rock and roll material just to prove that I could do it. You know, like I said before, I don't need to prove anything about that. There'll be another day for those shows. You know, the show will be about the feeling that's in these new songs and other songs that resonate with that. And I want it to be a strong, you know, intense. Mm-hmm.
Would a song like Allison, for instance, be out of place?
I don't think so, because it, you know, it has some resonance. Whether or not it makes the cut, I don't know. We haven't rehearsed yet, you know. But I mean, it wouldn't be impossible to imagine that song. I mean, that's a song I still play, and there were times in my early career when I felt uneasy with it, because it was one that I was best known for early on. And that became a burden of the expectation of playing it. And I've heard of different people dropping their most famous song, you know, over the years. I see bands do it, come up, they have a hit, and then they drop that hit. And I sort of try and get, you know, if I could get whisper in their ears, say, you know, there'll be one day when, not for sentiment, not for business, not for commerce, but just because a song meant something, and you might look at it differently, and 2 years down the road, you might think you hate it right now, because you think people don't understand all the breadth of your work, you know. But they will if you're any good. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're any good, they're gonna take, you know, not everybody. You know, not everybody in the world can hear you. It's, well, I'm trying to be a popular songwriter and singer. Mm. I'm not trying to be a dictator, you know.
Well, feel free to say no, and I know you will. But would you sing Allison for us?
Oh.
Could you do it?
Can I sing two songs?
I would. Yeah. Can you sing? You can sing as many songs as you want, please.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. With the way you look, I understand that you were not impressed. I thought you heard that little friend of mine take off your party dress. I'm not gonna get too sentimental like those other sticky Valentines, 'cause I don't know if you were loving somebody. I only know it isn't mine. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Allison, my aim is true. Well, I see you got a husband now. Did he leave your pretty fingers lying in the wedding cake? You used to hold him right in your hand, but he took all he could take. Sometimes I wish that I could stop you from talking when I hear the silly things that you say. I think somebody better put out the big light, 'cause I can't stand to see you this way. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Allison, my aim is true.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm all goosebumpy, man. God, that's incredible.
See, I relearned that song because I went down to Brazil with the Mingus Big Band about this time last year to play the Free Jazz Festival. It was one of the most unusual invitations I've had in the last couple of years. I got to do a number of things, like with the Jazz Passengers, mm-hmm. and Bill Frisell, mm-hmm. and with John Hall from the modern classical world. Just being a vocalist with people. Like in between when I left Warner Brothers and Johnny Mercury, I had this opportunity to do a number of records and sometimes guest on stage with these people. And I got an invitation from Sue Mingus to go with the Mingus Band.
This is the band that plays here.
It plays down at the Fez. Yeah. And we rehearsed live on stage down there, uh-huh. for a couple of weeks. And I wrote some words for a Mingus tune from the 40s called This Subdues My Passion, which is a beautiful piece. And she invited me to write a lyric for it. And so we did that and Weird Nightmare, which I recorded for Hal Wilner's record a few years ago, but doing it in the original Mingus chart. And I adapted a couple of charts, one of Bill Frisell's, of a song I wrote for Charles Brown called Upon a Veil of Midnight Blue, and another song of mine that I wrote a chart for a chamber group called Almost Blue. And we reworked those arrangements for the Mingus configuration and went down to Brazil. So here I am down in Brazil, never been in Brazil professionally in my life. They didn't know what I was going to sing. I turn up and I'm singing two Charles Mingus songs and, you know, two songs in completely unrecognizable arrangements, and the audience was tremendously tolerant. I mean, they'd come to hear Lee Konitz and Marcus Roberts and mm-hmm. the Mingus mm-hmm. band. I was kind of like something of an anomaly, really, at the festival.
So you worked up Allison?
No, while I was out there, I got interviewed, and they wanted me to play, like, something from they were talking to me, much as we are tonight, and just about a wide range of topics, and suddenly I'm in Brazil with all that kind of music in my head, and I started playing the song like it was a Hobim song or something, like I Can't Sing as Quiet or as Beautiful, like Charlotte Gilberto would do, you know, like, started playing it like this. you know, real quiet, and just trying to get it in that place, and it put the song back in my hands, really. Just that experience being asked to sing it that day, a bit like you just did.
It was
each time, kind of the chance encounter of it, if I had to think about it.
Yeah.
And then I started sort of playing it on stage, like just with a torch on stage. I did a tour in Italy where I played opera houses with Steve Naive. We were playing opera houses, mainly because they sound beautiful, not that we were doing opera, but we were doing a wide range of stuff from 1997 back to 1977, going, you know, because in the piano and guitar format you can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can rework songs, even rhythmic songs, quite effectively. And I would sometimes just get a torch and just tell a completely bogus story about how I did used to get into the darkest, quietest room in the house when I wrote songs. And when you get back to the way they're written like that, in the most intimate way, you see, even the loudest, most aggressive song sometime in, you know, when you were writing, even a rock and roll song would be like, you know, you're whispering to yourself,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of the reasons Chrissy Hynde is so great, you know, because she never really altered the dynamic of her vocal. She sings all of her songs in the same dynamic she wrote them in, which is basically hiding in a cupboard in the back of somebody's apartment,
uh-huh.
You know, trying not to be overheard. And then she just put that beautiful voice in front of a rock band, and she's got a killer, you know, knockout sound there, you know.
What did you mean by using the word torch just now?
Sorry?
You used the word torch just
now. I actually sat there like with a torch trying to simulate kind of the feeling of like being in like a small place, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, I took a right turn there or a left.
No, okay,
turn,
okay. Yeah. So you mean actually physically
I just put this torch on the stage and turn all the lights in the hall out and just played a domestic torch. And just you know, I make a joke about it, say, you know, like, well, Pink Floyd, I got that big pig, and U2 got that big arch, and I've got this torch,
you've got your ever ready.
At this point of my career, I'm trying to go for that sympathy from the audience, you know.
Would you do something else for us?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to get out of here in a minute because I'm gonna be on that. I'm sitting on that David Letterman show tomorrow evening. You know, we're going to do that. So.
You and Backrack are going to do that together?
Yeah, but now I'm going to go in and play I Still Have That Other Girl on the David Letterman show tomorrow night. So.
And I understand you're also doing one of the morning TV shows this week.
You're doing Regis and Kathy Lee.
Regis and Kathy.
It's going to be a riot.
Elvis Look and Kurt and Regis and Kathy Lee. Yeah.
Together for the first time. Looking forward to that one. And we're just going to try and, you know, I want to, you know, we've been fortunate in the last couple of months to talk to a number of different magazines. And the one thing about this sort of record is that it doesn't go in a pigeonhole too easily. So, like, we've been interviewed by The New Yorker and by the New Musical Express and by, you know, GQ and funny sort of combination. It's not like the obvious outlets for music journalism or some of them, but contrasting with that. And I feel that's the way that people will get to hear about the record.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it'll get played on the radio, and we're going to play live. We're going to play here in Radio City on the 13th. We're going down to Washington two nights later. Then we go to Chicago, and then we're going out to Los Angeles to do a show, and then we're going to do one in London on the 29th. So it's kind of just the beginnings of playing together live.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, we've talked about having this Burt and Elvis Palooza kind of thing where we stay on stage maybe for like 3 days and play the song we know, but you know, right now we've got the problem of how we get together and find out which songs to play.
You think you'll do all 12 songs from the album?
I don't see why not. That's the thing that we're most proud of. Right. I mean, I'm not saying we're doing them like it's a suite, you know, but we probably will intersperse them with a number of other songs from other times, but it could be that we will play them all. I don't know. We you know, we have to really time the show.
I'm watching the clock here, and I have to do some commercials before you do another song for us. This is WNEW-FM in New York. I'm Vin Scalza. Idiot's Delight is the name of the show. I've been real happy to have Elvis Costello as my guest for the last almost 2 hours. Elvis has promised to come back sometime and spend a whole night with us. He'll bring his record collection and everything. Because we've barely scratched
the
surface.
Let's see if we can get the truck up the stairs.
We've barely scratched the surface of
Painted From Memory. Not a lot of talking tonight. I hope that hasn't been too trying on people.
This is good.
I guess your audience is used to that, you know. But it would be fun to come and maybe spin a few platters, as they used to say.
Okay. There are some who will complain, though, in the audience and say, you know, we only did a couple of songs live. But that's where we are tonight.
You know, I've been trying to think what I was going to sing. I was going to sing one, but you know, you've got to come to the show People have got to come to the show to find out which songs that we're going to play. And if I play all the songs, I'm going to be giving away which ones are in my mind, you know. And,
okay.
And one of the things that, you know, that we're going to do that's unique to the show, when we play at Radio City on the 13th, it'll be, you know, sort of which songs of my catalogue that fit into that show, and also songs of Bert's from his back, particularly from the Bacharach David catalogue. I'm going to do some of those for the first time on stage. Mm-hmm. About five songs in the set will come from that very rich catalogue. So that's going to be like a thrill and a challenge and be kind of scary, you know. But I'm not going to sing any of them tonight because that'll give the game away.
Okay. Is Hal David still alive?
Mm.
Yeah. Do they talk? I mean, their parting of ways was not amicable.
No, but I think they wrote a song for the revival of Promises, Promises. I know that.
Okay.
Mm. I think they might be working on something.
Really?
Now and again, you know, I'm sure, time wounds all heals, as they say.
That's what they say.
Is that right? So, I mean, it's the old clock on the wall says it's time to go. And as they used to say, it sounds like a sort of Hank Williams show, doesn't it? And I'm going to sing a song that I've never done on there. I don't think, I may have sung this on stage here, but I've never recorded it. And I've never performed it, I don't think, on the radio or television in America. It's a song I wrote for Ronnie Drew of the Dubliners. And he made a solo album in Ireland a couple of years ago. He's not a singer that people are familiar with, I wouldn't have thought. But it seems to be fitting with some of the things we've been talking about tonight. You know, the relationship with the past as much as anything. I told him anyway when I gave him this song that it was about an old fighter. I wanted to put a picture of a character in his head that he could relate to, I said to picture an old boxer who's in a bar every night, who all his cronies come up to him and want him to relive all his old former glories and tell us about that time when you knocked that guy out and gave him a cauliflower ear and all that sort of, you know, talk. And he doesn't really need to do that anymore. He already knocked the guy out, you know. He doesn't need to live in the past like that. So, I mean, that's what I told him it's about. You can draw your own conclusions what I might think it's about, you know. And really, now and again, I think it would have been better sung by Bing Crosby, but, you know, sadly he's not around to do it. It's in the style of Bing Crosby as he would have sung Galway Bay, you know. Oh, this will be my attempt to do it. What a lot of nonsense.
I recall the good old days, but thankfully they've gone. Now the ponies are all broken necks that stumble as they groan and throw the jockeys from their thrones. As there are ditches left to dodge and lions still to tame, it's nothing but a dirty, rotten shame. Oh, it's a dirty, rotten shame that when you're frivolous and strong, it isn't youth, it's fearlessness that has been wasted on the young. The cruel are in the cradle, the bishops in the back. It's nothing but a dirty, rotten shame. Now I sound like a millionaire who brags of rags to jewels. A snarling pup is wild enough, but as his anger cools, he's left to sharpen useless tools. They're tearing, grazing, find a phrase though few are worth the name. It's nothing but a dirty, rotten shame. Oh, it's a dirty, rotten shame. And that is not an idle boast. That all your courage and your strength will leave you as you need it most. As there are lamps to dampen and cauliflowers to clip, it's nothing but a dirty, rotten shame.
Dirty Rotten Shame.
Rotten Shame.
Yeah, it's on a Rhino record that they put out a record of songs I'd written called Rendezvous, Lost Dogs, and something or other. I don't know.
I have it right here.
It's on there somewhere.
Bespoke Songs.
Bespoke
Lost
Songs.
Detours,
yeah.
And Rendezvous.
Yeah, they collected together all these things that were a little hard to find, and some things that were, you know, kind of successful and popular. But
there it is.
It was a nice compliment they paid me there.
Ronnie True. That's great.
Yeah, Ronnie's got a slightly different vocal delivery to mine. I'd sort of hear it in that old world style, but Willie Nelson sing it good, I think.
I really
hear him sing it. I must send it to him.
Are there people already expressing interest, vocalists expressing interest in recording these new songs?
We hear a couple of whispers, but I mean, it hasn't been long for them to hear them. The only one I know of is really that Cassandra Wilson has guested on the Verve record that will be coming out in the new year.
Uh-huh. But that's mostly an instrumental album.
It's mostly instrumental, and I made a guest appearance on it. Also, I sang with her on one song and on one cut. You know, I don't know. They haven't put the album together, so I don't know whether they're going to include everything that we recorded. But Cassandra did a lovely version of Painted from Memory.
Mm.
Which
mm-hmm.
I thought was great, and we sang together on another cut, and I did a solo guest appearance, which was interesting to sort of sing the song again, only a few months after doing the original version, but with a completely
different orchestration.
And different kind of nuances to the arrangement, you know. So, I mean, I look forward to playing them on stage, obviously, right now it's our record, Painted from Memory, and then, you know, whatever people want to do with them, I would love to hear some people sing them. You know, Dusty would have sung some of these great, sadly she's not in great health at the moment. Maybe she'll recover enough health to record one of them. That would be the thrill, really, you know, because I wrote a song for her, but, it wasn't the best song I could have written, maybe, you know.
Mm. It's such a wonderful collection that it's ripe for the plucking, you know.
Well, I look forward to hearing what people do with it, and maybe that's the case. Bert's certainly a much more covered songwriter than I am, so maybe the element of the collaboration maybe opens it up to that possibility mm-hmm. a bit more than if it had simply been a number of my songs, you know.
This new album is entitled Painted from Memory. Elvis Costello with Bert Bacharach is how it's billed. It's Elvis and Bert. They will be together with a big orchestra on stage at Radio City. 30-piece.
It's a swinging little band, yeah.
And
at the Radio City Music Hall.
Backup vocalists as well, I would assume.
Oh, the full, right? Yeah. We tried to make a band that can play the sound of the record, right. You know, the vocal group, string section, and some of the horn players and rhythm section, obviously, you know.
Now, when you do Letterman tomorrow night, will it just be you and Bert?
And I think a string section, and a house band, of course, plays the rhythm section role in that.
Okay, so they
that's
will
what
play.
They did on God Give Me Strength.
Right,
I'm hoping they're ready to play it. I mean, we get there and they're not there. No, they're there every night, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, so that's guess how we're going to do it. You know,
you want to tell us what song you're going to do tomorrow night?
Yeah, we're going to do I Still Have That Other Girl.
You will?
Yeah, that's a song, you know, I mean, for one thing, you know, on TV shows, I always want it to be in a good short length, and that's our shortest song that we have, you know, so I think it's a very concise and a good telling of a good starting point for people to hear. I mean, I don't know whether you really call it a single, but it's a song that is being focused on, I know initially by people, I mean, that's one that I hope that anybody might be tempted to play on the radio.
It's the one that has been released.
Yeah,
as
in that
single.
Sense. And
yeah.
I think because it's short and it's also a good dialogue of our writing styles. There's not, it's one of the ones where neither one of us is too dominant, musically speaking.
I happen to have it queued up, Elvis Costello.
Oh, that's very good. Well, I'll say goodnight to you and get on and get
all
some,
right.
Some
I am going to hold you to your promise to come back.
Yeah. I don't know when it'll be possible to do, whether next time I'll be in town will be a pretty frantic time with the show, but I certainly would love to do it sometime.
Okay. You have an open invitation.
Thank
sir.
You. Thank you.
I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this.
Good night to the listeners.
Elvis Costello.
Tell you how to do your business, but that my friend is a band. You know what I'm saying? That is a band.
I hear you, man.
I'll talk to you about it later.
Cool.
Our next guests are two immensely talented and influential figures in popular music. They have collaborated on this wonderful new CD. It's entitled Painted from Memory, which is due in stores tomorrow. Please welcome back to the program our old buddy Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach. Kids.
That we should finish it now before we weaken, 'cause we already know this is wrong. I could give in sometimes and think that I will, despite the temptation I try to beat very strong. In my reluctance seems a surprise. It's not that I don't want you, but I just know I must hesitate. There may be ugly rumors that I have been lying. There may be angry tears, but then sometimes I hesitate.
Come on, stand up. And the kids in the band. back, ladies and gentlemen. Beautiful, isn't it? Elvis Costello, Burt Bacharach. Nice, good to have you guys here. That string section, now how many people, how many pieces in that string section?
Four violins, two violas, two cellos.
And they're all women. Now, is,
beautiful
is that,
women.
Oh, absolutely. Is that by design or is that unusual to have all string, all female?
Well, we thought it was the Day of Love vibe.
You
thought that was part of the rules.
You thought it was the Dave Love vibe?
Oh, it must be the Burt and Elvis Love vibe.
Oh, man. Well, anyway, whatever it is, it's a very impressive thing, you know, sight and sound. It couldn't be a greater combination. And you guys are a pretty good combination as well. And how long have you been working together, collaborating together, and how did that begin?
Well, we sort of started on your show. We did the first song
right.
that we had written, God Give Me Strength, and... You know, we had made this record, and that was about 2 years ago, and we started to write songs after that, and because it felt so good.
Yeah, it seems to be producing great results, obviously, with the CD, and you guys are still speaking, so that's good,
yeah.
right? Everything's
well,
going
well. We're going on the road, you know, that's a big, that's
that'll
the big,
the
next week.
That's the deal breaker.
It'll be at Radio City on the 13th, and then we're going to Washington. And
when you guys travel, will it be more than just the string section? Will it be like a huge orchestra, big deal?
Well, we'll have a core band very much like this band that you have, yeah. like Paul's band. And a string section.
Yeah, very exciting.
Practically this whole string section.
Yeah. You want to come?
I'd love to come.
Yeah, you have to come. Yeah.
Come to Radio City.
Come to Radio City, Dave.
It's Elvis Costello, Burt Bacharach, and it's in stores tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
So this is it. You know, chances are if you're up watching this show, you're not going to make it to work anyway. So.
Just forget about it.
Go by the store and pick up a copy of this, and I think you'll be glad you did, as they say on radio and TV. Elvis, good to see you. Thank you very
good
much.
You,
beautiful as always. Burt, pleasure to have you back here. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. My thanks to everybody who was on the program tonight. Chris Kattan, Fran Drescher, Elvis and Burt. We'll see you tomorrow. Tom Snyder is next. Thanks for watching. Good night, everybody.
Hey, Brenda.